In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Thank you very much for listening on Friday, February 15th, 2013, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by my experts in the world of the federal government. And this week, it is John Kamensky of the IBM Center for the Business of Government. Good to see you, as always, my friend.
And thank you very much.
Happy to have you here. And Ron Sanders of Booz Allen. Always good to see you, sir, as well. Thank you for coming in today.
Same here, Francis. Glad to be here.
We have a few things going on in our world to talk about.
This was a great week.
Yeah, you're not kidding. I mean, there's plenty to talk about. And we will hit a lot of subjects here in the course of the hour in the Federal News Countdown. The third most important federal news story of the week is selected by Ron Sanders is a story from GovExec, which is headlined Federal Pay Groundhog Day. And it just we just learned within the last hour or so, Ron, that Congressman DeSantis's bill to freeze federal pay is through the House. And I have to confess that my response to that was big whoop, because right. It seems to be headed nowhere fast.
Deja vu all over again.
Yeah.
And I don't want to play that game with you, because I respect you so much.
When did that start?
I've been on here a couple of times, and I've always had that as one of my stories, and this has been going on for a year. And I don't see any end in sight. Here's my wish. I wish that I had a different story, because it seems to me that while the issue of federal pay is controversial, the flip side of it is it's begging to be fixed. It's begging to be fixed in either grand ways or incremental ways. So wouldn't it be nice if, for example, instead of an all or nothing, I'm not sure most federal employees would see 0.5% as all versus nothing, but that's the poles of the continuum here. Wouldn't it be nice to take a more occupation and market-based approach, particularly in one area where we'll talk about IT workers, mm-hmm. where that labor market is heated up again. This is like, again, deja vu all over, like the mid-90s. The federal government is increasingly not competitive for IT talent, and we'll talk about cybersecurity later in the hour. That's worrisome to me, and to treat this as one size fits all and all or nothing is problematic when it comes to compensation strategy. Wouldn't it be nice to say we're going to put some of this money where we know we're really far behind and make sure that we're more competitive in those critical skill areas? It may come at the expense of others, but again, at the end of the day, 1% or 0.5% isn't going to make a difference in the grand scheme of things. It may make a difference when it comes to attracting and retaining a skilled IT worker.
The thing about this particular subject that I found most interesting this week is Steny Hoyer was on the program, on the morning show, a week or a week and a half ago, and said that everything should be on the table, including tax increases and spending cuts and federal employee pay and benefits included in there. But he was not in favor of this bill because it strips this out and kind of sets it off to the side as its own separate thing. It just struck me as interesting that somebody who has historically been an advocate for the federal employee is saying that should also be in the pot.
Well, I think the premise is if it were part of a grander bargain where everybody gives a little to the greater good, I think it would be easier to take. In this case, it's isolated. I'd push the envelope a little bit further. Maybe it's not part of a grand bargain. Maybe it's part of a micro bargain. I'd like to see pay increases, however modest they may be, tied to the beginnings of civil service reform. Let's fix the pay system, or if that's too far a bridge, maybe we start with the classification system. All right, we're going to freeze it until it's fixed, mm-hmm. so that we begin to move the ball forward, because right now we're in a do loop. And we're not getting anywhere. And as the economy improves, those highest performers, those with the most critical skills, are going to vote with their feet.
John, you're seeing this in some of the work that you're doing for the IBM Center, that this is a lot. The numbers come back survey after survey after survey that employees don't work for the government for the money, and yet it's a concern. It's something that's on people's minds.
Well, especially when you take this out for a number of years, freeze out for period of years. That's when it makes a difference to people's pay. But from a year-to-year basis, you know, 0.5% or 1% or something, that's not a factor. And I think it's more, it's almost become symbolic at that point as whether they got a pay raise, whether it's, you know, 0.5% or not. But it becomes more symbolic.
The third most important federal news story of the week is selected by Ron Sanders as the GovExec story, Federal Pay Groundhog Day. John, your third most important story of the week is from the LA Times. Government says it recovers billions in health fraud crackdown. And this has been a signature effort of the administration to try to cut down on improper payments. This sounds like a huge success story.
Well, and that's why I flagged it as a story for this week, even though there's a lot of other significant things going on. That media covers success stories is almost a story. And so that's why I thought this was significant. It said the federal government recovered a record $4.2 billion this past year from Medicare, medical providers, and others who fraudulently bill the government health care programs. It's significant because that's almost $1 trillion a year that's spent between those two programs. And the new health care law gives more authority to weed out fraudulent providers and to keep them from ever coming back to the system. But there's a broader story about progress on improper payments. And this is not just a Medicare and Medicaid issue. It's also other agencies such as IRS and others. And it's their use of analytics and their use of a systematic approach to identifying improper payments. And what's interesting also is that the Sandy Relief Bill extended the Recovery Act Transparency Board because it was so successful in developing a cross-agency operations war room, if you want to call it that, to track down improper payments to be able to deal with fraudulent vendors and all. But it's not just this, but there's a broader story of success that's hidden in a lot of other agencies, VA and DOD on their electronic health care. So there's a lot of cool things that are going on, and this is just a great example of something that's been in the media.
I'm hearing from some of my friends in the vendor community some concern that budget problems will force agencies, they are afraid, to not be able to invest in analytics for all this big data right at a time where they're close but not quite ready to make a really good return on investment case. This kind of thing must be very helpful for that, I would imagine. But that's still a concern from the people that can provide those analytics services to governments.
Yes, that's true. The challenge is, and it's ironic, that in order to save $1 billion, you may need to spend, you know, a million.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't get the million, or you lose $1 billion,
yeah,
as opposed to save. So,
yeah. The information that we get from big data, Ron, the problem right now seems to be more conceptual than mechanical. It's imagining all of the things that you might be able to do, all of the information that might be available to you, if you, just by applying the right analytic concepts to it.
Well, that's become sort of the solution du jour. I really think at the end of the day, though, it has so much to do with agency and institutional culture. Are they willing to embrace this new thing? But more importantly, we talk about improper payments. John's just enumerated a couple of one-offs. Something good's going on over here. Something good's going on over there. How can we find those nuggets of real management reform and spread them across the entire federal government? We're working on a report with a Partnership for Public Service on management reform, and that's one of the things we hope to do, not just to point out here are some nuggets, everybody ought to do them, but then to institutionalize a process so that as individual agencies or bureaus innovate, those innovations can become institutionalized. To me, that's the real secret here.
The third most important federal news story of the week, as selected by John Kaminsky, is from the LA Times. The headline is, Government Says It Recovers Billions in Health Fraud Crackdown. It is linked up, like all of our stories, at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Second most important federal news story of the week is next on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Federal Living Report, brought to you by WEPA.
Sequestration guidance is on its way for civilian federal employees. Agencies have been given the go-ahead to tell feds how the automatic budget cuts could impact them. The notices being sent to employees will present a range of options that could be taken if the budget cuts are implemented, including furloughs and cuts to travel and training. Agencies are also reviewing contract spending for potential savings. A deal to avert sequestration must be reached by March 1st.
Does your spouse need additional or less expensive life insurance coverage? WEPA's Associate Member Program allows spouses of civilian federal employees to become associate members and apply for coverage up to $750,000. And the good news is that you, as the federal employee, are not required to purchase any insurance, and your spouse does not need to be a federal employee. To learn more, visit WAEPA.org. Once again, that's WAEPA.org.
The Guiding You Home Safely Report, provided and paid for by the National Air Traffic Controllers Association.
The federal debt limit extension deal passed by Congress assures the federal government will not default on its loans through mid-May. But military budget experts say the extension deal could also increase the chances of sequestration. In the continuing budget fight, both parties are so well entrenched in their opposition of other alternatives, such as tax increases or entitlement cuts, it's possible that sequestration may be the least common denominator between the two parties. Sequestration could have a negative impact on jobs, the nation's economy, and essential government services.
Hi, I'm Trish Gilbert, Executive Vice President of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. The men and women of NACA run the safest, most efficient aviation system in the world. And last year, we had the safest record in aviation history, moving nearly 750 million passengers through our nation's airspace. Next time you get on a plane, remember that air traffic controllers are the professionals guiding you home in the safest airspace in the world. Visit us at NATCA.org, NACA.org.
Enjoy the comedy of Emmy Award-winning Dana Carvey and dance the night away to the sounds of Jim Belushi and the Sacred Hearts Band at the 26th Annual Leukemia Ball, presented by Bio in partnership with Genentech, Saturday, March 23rd at the Washington Convention Center. D.C.'s largest non-political fundraiser features a world-class silent auction with travel packages from American Airlines and a chance to win one of two Mercedes-Benz. D.C.'s largest non-political fundraiser, the Leukemia Ball, supports the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society's critical research and patient services programs. There are more than 19,000 people in the D.C. metro region living with leukemia, lymphoma, or myeloma. Someone is diagnosed with a blood cancer every 4 minutes. Help the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society cure blood cancer by attending this can't-miss event. To purchase a ticket, please call 703-399-2900. That's 703-399-2900. Or visit leukemiaball.org.
Tom Temin here with a preview of Monday's Federal Drive. What will John Kerry really have to know before he sets foot in the cauldron of the Middle East? A former advisor to secretaries of state has some insight. Plus, what are your legal rights as a federal employee if you're forced into a furlough and loss of pay? Answers in our legal loop. Those stories and much more Monday morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Ron Sanders and John Kaminsky, and we are up to...
Number two!
The second most important federal news story of the week, as selected by John Kaminsky, is Jason Miller's story on federalnewsradio.com. The headline is, IRS Program Interagency Contracting Finally Removed from the High Risk List. This is a big deal every year, John, when the high risk list comes out, and there have been years past where nothing comes off, where the list stays pretty static. So 2 out of 30 in 1 year is a pretty decent accomplishment, it looks like to me.
Well, what I thought was interesting was the way the story was told. In Federal News Radio, it was 2 come off the list, and one of your competitors said 2 new ones on the list.
Uh-huh.
So you focused on the positive. So congratulations.
Well, thank you. And we detailed the programs that went on the list. You can read that story at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. But interagency contracting in particular is extremely complicated. We're going to have Dan Gordon on the program this afternoon. Good. In the 5 o'clock hour to talk about how that worked and the efforts that he did at OFPP to make that happen. But that one, as you well know, because it involves multiple agencies communicating with each other, different ways of communicating, different languages they speak, essentially, strikes me as the more complex of these, although I'm certainly downplaying the IRS
one
business
modernization.
One
was the IRS business modernization, and that went on the list in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just coming off now. So that's been, you know, there for a while.
Yeah.
And but the interagency contracting, when you're right, is something that it's because there's a process that each agency has developed their own, that they're finally coming down to an ability to be able to validate, you know, the transfers of money and the contracts and internal between different agencies is a really big step.
Yeah. You've studied, Ron, any number of different methods and ways that agencies communicate with each other. What are the successful ones and where do those relationships usually go wrong?
You mean in terms of interagency collaboration?
Yeah, on any subject, not just contracting.
I think there are some preconditions. Having a shared mission, having a shared language. We know that agencies struggle in collaborating with one another because, frankly, their business processes don't match up. In many cases, they call things differently. One an acronym means one thing in one agency, another in their partner.
Mm-hmm.
So I think having shared mission, sharing values, I'm a fan of hostage exchanges where they share people. We did this in the intelligence community. The military has done it as well with something called joint duty. Where people, as part of their development as professionals and leaders, move from one agency to another. In the IC, they used to call it an out-of-body experience. But I think once you've walked a mile in another agency's shoes, it's far easier to collaborate. You've built relationships of trust with other people. You know who to call. You know their culture and traditions. That's when it works, and without it, it's very hard.
That would be it would be very helpful in that realm, John, if we saw more of what the senior executive service was originally intended for, which was to be a lot more mobile and a lot more fluid than what we see it actually turn out to be now.
Well,
is that right?
We just the IBM Center released a report earlier this week. It's a federal guide on interagency collaboration, and it centers on around two things. One is, do you have the right skill set as leaders? But the others, do you have the right governance or processes that are needed to be for those leaders, in fact, to be successful? Because you can have very successful leaders or very good leaders, but if they're put in a bad system, they can't succeed.
Which is first, though? Is that a chicken or the egg thing where you can't?
It's a bit of both.
Yeah.
I mean, good leadership can engender good process. Good process can help somebody that may not be a strong leader to actually be successful.
And that goes back to a conversation that you and Jeff Neal and I had not too long ago about leadership and how you cultivate leaders, the skill sets and all of that. The selection process is maybe could stand a little bit.
Well, and I'll certainly second and third your motion about the SES, because that was the original vision way back in my youth, and I think we've lost sight of that. I'm optimistic when I hear some of the things that John Barry and Steve Shee talk about at OPM about sort of reinvigorating that original model, because I do think it's the answer to these interagency challenges that so many face.
What I wonder, though, is it would be fine for Director Barry and for Steve to say, this is what we're going to do and this is how we want to try to stir this up. My fear is that the people that are in the SES are so used to the way that it is now that it might be difficult to spark interest in getting them to actually do it.
But the goal isn't to do it for all 7 or 8,000 SESers. Where's the next 100 Thad Allens? Somebody that is a proven leader that's been successful and working cross-agency boundaries, in fact, across sector boundaries. It's how do you identify those? They're probably out there. It's just that we don't have a way of filtering them out or being able to create a pipeline to create more.
That pipeline question is the big question, it seems to me, Ron.
Oh, absolutely. And, again, I'm encouraged by some of the things I've been hearing. But your point, Francis, you need infrastructure. You need process. My bet is you've got a lot of GS-15s and Tier 1 SESers out there who would love to take on an interagency assignment, but they have to fend for themselves. And if you had a mechanism that that enabled that, it would go a long way. Again, that was our experience in the IC. Paige Hinkle-Bowles and Pat Tamburino and DOD have been working the department's SES core towards that goal. I think you've got to build a foundation of process.
Yeah. But then this all piles on top of each other, Ron, because to go back to what we talked about in the first segment about restructuring pay scales and so on, I had a GS-15 tell me just a week ago, and someone you know, there's no incentive for me to go into the senior executive service financially. Job satisfaction is one thing, but financially there's no incentive for me to take on the added responsibility and the added everything because I'm going to make as much or maybe less than I make now as a 15.
Yeah, that's problematic. I really do think we need to reimagine the SES. It's not just going back to the original vision. I think we need to modernize that vision. create enterprise leaders mm-hmm. whose challenges cut across government. I think those kinds of challenges will overcome some of the pay compression issues that we'll always face in government.
We got far afield on this when the second most important federal news story of the week from John Kaminsky is Jason Miller's story on federalnewsradio.com, headlined IRS Program and Interagency Contracting Finally Removed from the High Risk List. And you can read more about that on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Ron Sanders' choice for the second most important federal news story of the week is coming next on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Leader in informational seminars on federal benefits, financial, and retirement planning. NITP was established in 1984 and is 100% devoted to federal planning seminars. The mission is to educate federal employees and enable them to make fully informed decisions regarding their financial futures and retirement options. Through a variety of teaching platforms and seminars, NITP has the experience to help with your planning needs. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com for more information.
The men and women of our National Guard and Reserve Forces are working hard on the battlefield and here at home. Employer support of the Guard and Reserve is working just as hard for them. For over 36 years, ESGR has paved the way for greater understanding between our Guard and Reserve Forces and their civilian employers, promoting a culture where all American employers support and honor the military service of their employees. Together, we all serve. To learn more, visit www.esgr.mil.
This is Aileen Black, Vice President of VMware Federal. When it comes to issues like IT consolidation and cloud computing, it can't be overstated. Experience matters. More federal IT infrastructure is virtualized on VMware to create elastic, self-healing, on-demand pools of IT resources than any other platform. In fact, our experience is one of the attributes noted in Gartner's Magic Quadrant on server virtualization. Chances are you know a VMware user. Most civilian and defense agencies use our technology to benefit their missions. Their VMware experience is evidence of the dramatic benefits virtualization delivers. Users can see up to 90% reduction in cost.
The Federal News Radio CXO Survey 2013 Priorities, underwritten by VMware and Carahsoft, provides insight into CIO's top priorities in 2013. Cloud, mobile, big data, and the changing landscape of budgets. Go to federalnewsradio.com. Keyword survey to see the results.
The Washington Wizards are back.
Spins, fades, bangs, scores, and one. Okafor.
Up court to Crawford. No look pass. Ariza. Stuff to it.
Crawford drives baseline. Whips it in the corner. Sheldon Mack for three.
Single game tickets are on sale now. Call 202-661-5050. That's 202-661-5050. Or buy your tickets online at washingtonwizards.com/tickets.
Listen to your heart. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Nicholas Garlow with HHS HealthBeat. Heart disease has red flags associated with it that you need to pay attention to. Some common symptoms of heart disease include shortness of breath, nausea, back pain, and overwhelming fatigue. Dr. Nikayla Cook is at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute of the National Institutes of Health.
The most common symptom of heart disease is having chest pain or chest tightness or a discomfort in the chest.
Don't ignore the red flags. Time is crucial.
If you're having symptoms of heart disease, it's important to take your risk seriously and take your symptoms seriously and call 911 if you're having symptoms.
The faster you take action, the better. If you are having symptoms of a heart attack, doctors can help you protect your heart.
If we can save minutes, we can save heart muscle.
Learn more at hearttruth.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Nicholas Garlow.
We are now more than 1 year into the Shared First strategy. Many first-year initiatives focused on simple feats like email, but virtually no area of IT is exempt, from data centers to mobile devices. With agencies due to deliver their enterprise roadmap for shared services to OMB, join AFSIA Bethesda on February 28th at the Bethesda North Marriott to hear top agency officials discuss the shift to more strategic sourcing and a greater focus on commodity IT. Register today at afsiabethesda.org/febbreakfast.
We're back at In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as chosen today by Ron Sanders and John Kaminsky. And we have a bit of an anomaly on the countdown this week. The second most called worse. Well, I did not call you the anomaly, but I can if it would make you feel better, if you have some kind of a need for that, Ron. Your second most important federal news story of the week is from the L.A. Times, and it's headlined, Obama Calls for Smarter Government, the State of the Union. And, John, your number one story of the week is also about the State of the Union address and references Smarter Government from Government Executive Magazine. What do you think, either of you, is the driver behind this Smarter Government claim when this is something that the administration's been working on for a long time? Why bring it up again now, do you think? Is it because of where we are budget-wise and so forth?
Well, I'm sure that's part of the driver. I hope it's more than a bumper sticker. I hope it's more than an oxymoron. If that's a strategic theme, it's the kind of thing that will excite a lot of people. And that's not to suggest that this administration or previous administrations haven't had a management agenda. But Francis and John, as you both know, improving management in the federal government, that's a tough nut to crack. I was, you know, that caused me to perk up sitting there on the couch listening to the State of the Union. And what I really hope is that there's some substance to follow it. What does smarter government mean? Is it reinventing government 2.0? Is it the 21st century version? We've made a heck of a lot of progress since the early and mid-90s. John was on one side of NPR. I was in the agencies in the trenches, but we were both, I like to think, both champions of that movement. But it was just the beginning. We've matured a lot with GPRA and now GPRMA. And there's so much that could be done under the heading of smarter government. One last thing. One of the reasons I'm so enthusiastic about it, in case you couldn't tell, I think it's largely independent of the role one envisions for government. There's absolutely no agreement in this town today about the role of government, and that role debate translates into size. But no one's going to argue that regardless of size and regardless of role, it ought to be smarter. So what does that mean? And I'm just beginning to think of all sorts of interesting things. I did want to mention one last thing, a report that Booz Allen and the Partnership for Public Service are working on management reform. And one of the things we decided early on was to avoid the usual litany of management reform lists, like improper payments. Not that that isn't important, but what's the 21st century demand of government? How do we make 21st century government smarter? So stay tuned, but I'm really... That could really be a rallying cry for the next 3.5 years if it's leveraged appropriately.
The first thing I think of when I think of smarter government is Office of Management and Budget, your former home, John. If you want to improve management, you're going to need a manager. We keep hearing that Jeffrey Zients is looking, maybe considering another position in the administration. He's the DDM. He's the acting director. So those two spots would be open if he became U.S. Trade Representative, is the job that we've heard. Shelley Metzenbaum has been in her job for the entire administration so far. I've never heard anything to indicate that she's thinking about leaving, but it certainly wouldn't be unreasonable after serving 4 years at a very high level like that for her to look to go in another direction. And that means some pretty significant openings at OMB.
It could be. But, of course, remember that for years, Jeff Zients was also touted to be the next Secretary of Commerce. So don't write him off yet. But I think that the smarter government theme is not so much doing what government does today, but doing it differently, doing different business models. One of the things that President Obama said was you look at how do you make immigration reform more efficient and effective. It's not just the policy side, but actually being able to give people an account. They can track the progress of their green card. They can transmit their fingerprints electronically or whatever that might be. But there's a lot of other things that with new technologies that have come on board in the past few years of doing things radically different in government. What's the role of mobile technology in citizen service delivery? What's the role, for example, of serious gaming, of using multiplayer games as a way of incentivizing citizens to participate in government in a way that they could help what some people are calling co-deliver services, where they help produce some of the services that are being delivered across the government?
I think I understand what serious gaming is, but give me a little thumbnail definition.
Well, a great example of something like that would be the health apps that Michelle Obama has encouraged the development of out of the Department of Agriculture on eating healthy, and that if you eat the right kinds of things that you get certain number of points and you try to beat your neighbors in terms of number of points that you have. So it's trying to take something that's a serious policy issue and trying to use that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, simulations and modeling goes back to big data. Those are all things that a smarter government, I think, could leverage. But I'll have to tell you, as important as OMB and OPM and GSA are, the central management agencies, two of the things that I think are significantly different now that I think could really drive smarter government that weren't in existence back in the day is something called the President's Management Council, and then the creation of chief operating officers and their subordinate CXOs, chief financial officer, CIO, et cetera. Those have evolved over the years, and we've added to the list. But I think what we've done is create a superstructure that could really drive reform, not from the top down. With all due respect, I'm not sure OMB is in a position to order a smarter government. They can incent a smarter government. They can set a strategic direction. They could measure progress. And my bet is that the folks at OMB would agree with that. This change has to come from the departments and agencies, not from the bottom up. That's really hard. We mm-hmm. saw that and tried that in reinventing government. But I really like the idea of COOs and CXOs, the PMC as a board of governors, really driving a smarter government agenda. We got to put some flesh on those bones, and it was just the briefest statement in the State of the Union. I'd really like to see that built out.
All right, let's take a break and come back and talk about this some more, because this is Ron Sanders' second most important federal news story of the week on the countdown, and it is also John Kaminsky's most important story, and we'll continue our conversation on In Depth with Francis Rose in just a minute on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The Washington Capitals are back.
Ovechkin down low, they score! Matt Hendricks, tic-tac-toe! Back to Green, he's at the top of the right circle. Ovechkin, he scores! There it is, number one of the season!
Single game tickets are on sale now. Call 202-661-5050. That's 202-661-5050. Or buy your tickets online at Ticketmaster.com.
Looking to make a career move in technology? Start your search at PowerJobs.com, the new career site made for Washington's top talent. New on PowerJobs.com this week.
Senior Director, U.S. IP Policy, U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Executive Director of Investor Relations, CACI. Director of Quality, Virginia Hospital Center. And Business Intelligence Analyst, Hickory Ground Solutions. Apply for these and other leading positions today at PowerJobs.com.
PowerJobs.com. Finally, a career site made for you.
Hundreds of thousands of furloughs and cuts to every agency program. That's the reality if sequestration goes into effect on March 1st. Will Congress and the White House be able to reach a deal to avert the $85 billion in cuts this year? Will federal employees be able to survive the one-day-per-week furloughs? And how hard will industry be hit? Federal News Radio is your source for the most up-to-date information on sequestration. Find it all at federalnewsradio.com/sequestration.
Newsmakers, talk to Jason Miller.
Donna Brockington is a D.C. resident and works for the Office of Personnel Management.
It's a lot easier to make federal employees the scapegoats of the deficit. We didn't create it. I know people who buy their own supplies to do their jobs, to do their federal government job. And it's time for them to stop blaming us as the scapegoats and putting us in the middle of all these fights and debates and taking money from us.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Ron Sanders and John Kaminsky. Ron's second most important federal news story of the week is from the L.A. Times about the State of the Union address and the reference to smarter government. John Kaminsky's number one story of the week is the GovExec story, headlined, Obama, We Need Smarter Government, from the State of the Union address. And, gentlemen, we talked in the last segment about, Ron mentioned, John, the infrastructure that is available in agencies with the COO and then the subordinate CXOs. Do they have the power, according to the letter of the law, they do? Do they have the power in reality to be able to execute generally across agencies, that do they have the leverage to be able to pull off the kinds of things that we've been talking about?
Well, there's a presumption that they have the power in the law, and not really. I mean, they're oftentimes given a responsibility, but they don't have any authority or power oftentimes. Some do, and it depends on the agency structure. For example, Roger Baker at VA has the authority of actually overseeing the IT investments and spending in that department, where not all CIOs have that. But the other thing is the premise that the transformation or the smarter government occurs through the mission support functions, which are the CFO or a CIO or chief acquisition officers. And I would say that it really happens in the mission, whether it's air traffic control or with the TSA or the IRS. It's those functions that do things that the people see. And that's where I think the transformation is should be focused if they take on that as a major initiative. Now, what I thought was also interesting was the conversation wasn't, let's reorganize. I think if you're talking about smarter, it may involve some reorganization, but that's not the focus. The focus is actually the end result of, do we deliver services better? Can we, as a government, integrate service delivery so a small business doesn't have to, if he or she changes their bank account, have to go to every agency they deal with and have to submit the same form over and over again? Can they just do it once? So those are the smarter things that I think that they're envisioning.
I've seen some experts that have said, Ron, that the era of reorganizing government may be over for the exact reason that John's talking about. Technology allows you to maintain an identity that is acceptable throughout government, and the technology can make the transition from agency portal to agency portal, whether it's online or in person, almost work seamlessly, where you would go to a government office if you even needed to show up in person, and you could transition through whatever connections you needed to.
I think technology is part of the answer. I do think, so long as you look at reorganization as with a single agency lens, you're right. You're just rearranging the deck chairs. I really think we need to start approaching problems as an enterprise, looking horizontally. Our problems today cut across agencies horizontally. We are vertically structured. That's a disconnect. But I want to go back real quick to your question about legal authority. One of the really fun things I've been able to do, Booz Allen's funded a research project with Steve Kelman up at Harvard. He used to be director of OFPP. And we've gone around and interviewed 10 outstanding sub-cabinet executives. They didn't decide they were outstanding. We got nominations from NAPA and the Partnership for Public Service and even OMB and GovExec magazine. And if your name showed up in all those places, we went to talk to you, and I can't reveal their names. We promised them anonymity. But I'll have to tell you, one of the common denominators that's emerging in these hours and hours of interviews, the outstanding sub-cabinet officials are masters at bureaucratic jujitsu. They worry less about their legal authority. They know their limits. This is all about networks and relationships and levers of change, and some of them are masters at it. The other common denominator, back to the theme we touched on earlier, most of them bring a rich, varied set of leadership experiences to their current job. I can't think of a single one that's grown up in a stovepipe. So they've had a chance to parachute in, make a difference in an organization, move on, and that's how you earn your black belt in bureaucratic jujitsu. And we need to figure out how we bottle it and develop it so that our leaders can practice it.
Does that fit with what you've seen, John, the same concepts as Ron's talking about?
Yes, and this is what SES Mobility is theoretically all about.
All right. The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Ron Sanders. It's about smarter government and State of the Union. And John Kamensky's number one story of the week, also about smarter government. Both of them linked up now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And hour number, I'm wrong. I'm ahead of myself. We still have Ron Sanders' most important federal news story of the week to cover next. To wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose, we'll be right back.
Now the Federal Living Report, brought to you by WEPA.
Sequestration guidance is on its way for civilian federal employees. Agencies have been given the go-ahead to tell feds how the automatic budget cuts could impact them. The notices being sent to employees will present a range of options that could be taken if the budget cuts are implemented, including furloughs and cuts to travel and training. Agencies are also reviewing contract spending for potential savings. A deal to avert sequestration must be reached by March 1st.
The start of a new year is one of the best times to review the state of your financial affairs. Unfortunately, many individuals overlook one of the most important aspects of their financial plan, life insurance. WEPA, a nonprofit association, enables federal employees to purchase better life insurance at far better prices. As a superior alternative or supplement to FEGLI, WEPA provides more coverage, more benefits, and greater flexibility, yet costs much less. Visit WAEPA.org to learn more.
Giving you the edge on healthy living. Here's Mayo Clinic Medical Edge. Living in 27 places over 52 years, it's been easy for Martha and Dick Olson to adapt to changes. At least until a few years ago, when Martha began to have a little trouble remembering new phone numbers, addresses.
And I will see somebody and I will think, now what was their name?
Martha was diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment, or MCI. That diagnosis prompted many questions. Questions that were answered at Mayo Clinic's Habit Program.
Habit is a form of memory, but it's the kind of memory that's preserved even as other aspects of your memory decline.
Dr. Glenn Smith says a key part of the program is learning to use a journal to keep track of things you want to remember. The program also focuses on staying active physically, mentally, and socially. And data shows it's working.
6 months out, people are still functioning as well as they did when they started.
For Medical Edge, I'm Tracy McRae.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday here on 1500 AM at 10 AM. Please join me this week for my special guest, David Green, author of Dollars and Cents, 10 Fundamentals of Financial Success. The show, Blueprint for Wealth, is brought to you by Odin Feldman and Pittleman, located in Reston, Virginia, serving the entire D.C. metro area. Visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
Really, one website to find all government and military events happening in our area?
I know. With GovEvents.com, it's so easy to find government and military-related events happening near me and around the world. I can search by keyword, date, location, live event versus webcast, and so much more. And best of all, it's completely free.
I can't believe I haven't heard of this site before. What is it again?
It's GovEvents.com, the best place to find government events that matter to you, near you.
We're back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, the most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Ron Sanders of Booz Allen on this week's Federal News Countdown, is from the Washington Post. The headline is, U.S. said to be target of massive cyber espionage campaign. And I must confess, I think the reporting in this article is terrific, Ron. Ms. Nakashima of the Post was not done any favors, I don't think, by her headline writer, because anybody that's been following this issue for more than about 20 minutes understands that the United States has been the target of cyber espionage campaign or campaigns for years and years now. This is not a new deal, is it?
No, it's not. But I think attribution is becoming the big deal here. And, you know, I've not read the classified national intelligence estimate that she writes about. I've just read the reports in open source. But I think the willingness now to name names, to say this is where it's coming from, that's the threat. And the threat is becoming more and more real. It's not academic. And it's not a kid sitting in his, you know, mother's basement eating Fritos and hacking government systems for fun. This is serious business. That's the threat. The response was the president's executive order on cybersecurity. And I think the consensus, and I'll include myself in that, is that it's a great start. It focuses on protecting critical infrastructure, on preserving that critical infrastructure. But with all due respect, here's what I think is missing. I think our most critical infrastructure when it comes to cybersecurity is people. There is a cyber talent gap. I'm privileged to be on a panel of the National Academy of Science looking at the U.S. cyber workforce and whether it should be professionalized. And we've held what could be called hearings. They're open sessions where people come and talk about that. We invite them. And I have to tell you, it's been pretty depressing because everyone says there's not enough of them. This is high-end skill. You got to begin developing, identifying the talent and developing in high school. Some of the countries named in the NIE literally produce 10 times as many computer engineers and computer scientists and mathematicians than we do. Now, quantity doesn't equate to quality, but the threat that's described in the NIE. To me, one of the ways to deal with that threat is through people, through human capital, not just in the federal government, although that's the tip of the spear, but every organization needs that high-end talent, and there's just not enough of it to go around.
John, this is a similar problem to what we have in the acquisition workforce in that we have a tremendous need, and we just can't crank the people out fast enough. The pipeline doesn't exist to push as many people through, mainly because it's a very time-intensive thing. You can't just send somebody for a certificate for 6 months and all of a sudden they're qualified as an acquisition professional or cyber professional. This is a years and years eight ball that we're behind.
This is actually qualitatively a bit different. I mean, with acquisition, you can do on-the-job training. You can do certification. But with cybersecurity, this requires somebody starting in middle school liking science or math or computational physics or something like that, and years and years, we're talking about PhD level type training. So this is even before you enter the government. So this is a very different kind of a challenge the government's facing.
The certification process is one thing. I mean, Ron, you and I have had conversations before about the variety of different flavors of cyber professionals that exist now, where 5 years ago even, it was pretty much somebody was a cyber professional or they weren't. Right. Now there are permutations of that that didn't exist before, and I imagine that complicates this whole process even more.
It does. There's almost as many permutations as there are threats. And that's one of the things that this National Academy of Science panel is studying. Should you professionalize the cyber workforce like the legal profession or the medical profession, where there's a common degree programs, accreditation, certification, licensure, examinations, continuing education? Or is this field just too dynamic that if you tried to do that, you'd always be one or two or ten steps behind? Mm-hmm. And my friend Alan Paller, who founded the SANS Institute, likes to talk about, he uses a medical analogy, but one aspect of it that I really like, John, to your point, something you can't learn on the job, but you teach doctors in residency. And wouldn't it be cool if we could set up that sort of environment so that young cyber professionals could get a chance to practice on patients, but under the adult supervision of a seasoned pro? So they can't break anything. The environment's closed off. It's not open to the net, et cetera. There are all sorts of creative ideas to develop cyber professionals. But as you suggested, you gotta identify STEM talent in high school and nurture it. The Booz Allen funded another report with the partnership on best practices in recruiting STEM talent. And that's one of the things we found. First of all, there are not enough best practices. These are one-offs, and every agency that hires STEM talent needs to be practicing them. The report will be out in a month or so. But one of the really creative best practices is what I'd call upstream recruiting. Agencies are at science fairs in high school. Mm-hmm. And those agencies that are fortunate enough to have scholarship authority to give a kid 4-year free ride, you do that with a football player. I think it's so cool to do that with a math major.
Mm-hmm.
And we need that pipeline.
The pipeline development is one aspect of this. The other one is the national security element. And we haven't talked about one particular word that gets a lot of play in our circles right now. But with the budget numbers coming down, there's some fear that this could be an area that sees some budget reductions just at a time where we're starting, as you mentioned, Ron, to be able to attribute these attacks more and have a sense of what we need to do in response.
That's really scary because if you turn off the pipeline, if you absent yourself from college campuses, target schools because of hiring freezes, you may find that when you go back, there's no talent left. It's all going to the private sector or to government contractors. I am one now, and I'm not going to argue against that, but the fact of the matter is there are opportunities inside the federal government and for contractors to support and for private industry. But my humble opinion, as a former Fed, the Fed has to be in there competing. And, Francis, I'll take us full circle to my number three issue. Part of the equation is pay. Part of it is the lure of the job and the lure of the mission, but at the end of the day, part of it is pay, and I really worry that we're going to fall out of the competition just because of that when it comes to that high-end talent.
There's an existing model, and that is in the military. They have military academies, and it's not like they close them down when they have cutbacks. Mm-hmm. There has to be a commitment, and it needs to happen on the civilian side to fostering the talent.
An excellent conversation on the Countdown this week, gentlemen. We're almost out of time. Ron Sanders, your most important federal news story of the week is from the Washington Post. U.S. said to be target of massive cyber espionage campaign. All of our stories, as chosen by John Kaminsky and Ron Sanders, are posted at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Thank you very much for being on the show today, gentlemen.
Thank you, Francis.
Great to see you as always. Hour number two of In-Depth with Francis Rose next on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.